This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio and online at kpfa.org. My name is C.S. Song. A friend of mine, a former KPFA colleague, sometimes wore a t-shirt that said on the front, "Yes, I am black," and on the back of the shirt were the words, "No, I am not a criminal." That message suggests and confronts something my friend perceived and understood about prevailing attitudes toward African Americans. Now, what my friend and other blacks confront on a daily basis in the context of a society drenched in white privilege is elaborated in fascinating and provocative detail in a new book by George Yancey. The book is Black Bodies, White Gazes, The Continuing Significance of Race, and George Yancey teaches in the philosophy department at Duquesne University. George has edited numerous books, including Philosophy in Multiple Voices, White on White, Black on Black, and What White Looks Like, African-American Philosophers on the Whiteness Question. He joins us today to talk about Black Bodies, White Gazes, and specifically about the lived experiences of blacks in relation to whites, the nature of whiteness, and the contours of effective white anti-racist work. George Yancey joins us now by phone from Pittsburgh. Welcome, George.
Oh, thank you very much.
Thank you. Let me start by asking you about the project of this book. What's the basic project you've undertaken with this volume?
Sure. I think the basic project was really to look at the way in which philosophers have avoided the question of embodiment, particularly issues of racial embodiment. And I sort of take that theme from the work of Charles Mills, who talks about non-Cartesian sums. And by that he means this way in which we understand a philosophy from the perspective of those bodies that suffer in their embodiment. So unlike Descartes, where, you know, philosophy is done in this very abstract, disembodied fashion, the non-Cartesian sum, for an example, would be Ralph Ellison's Invisible Man, where he is constantly confronted with issues of invisibility, where whites refuse to see him. So it becomes, one, a very interesting way in which to do philosophy from this perspective of embodiment, and particularly from this perspective of invisibility, and also challenges, I think, the goals of philosophy and what philosophy ought to be about, right?
Can the history of the black body in the U.S. be separated from the history of whiteness?
Yes and no. No, in as much as I argue throughout the text, and I might explain that by way of a particular construct that I use in the book, namely whiteness as the transcendental norm. And technically, when I use that term in the book, I'm talking about referring rather to Immanuel Kant's claim that space and time are necessary and universal transcendental conditions for what he calls the possibility of experience. But to say that whiteness is the transcendental norm is not to say that whiteness is necessary or, in some sense, universal. It's to say that whiteness is the standard against which blackness is defined. So in that dialectical sense, no. Since whiteness is the transcendental norm, it basically means that other groups are, whether, you know, red groups, yellow groups, you know, what have you, are defined as different or deviant, while whiteness remains the same in some very fundamental way. And I'll tell you how this works. What's interesting is during the election, I asked my predominantly white students, what was it about this election that made it so unique? And without fail, they generally say race and gender. But by this they mean that, you know, there's a black candidate and there's a female candidate. Mm-hmm. In other words, whiteness and maleness here function as transcendental norms, whereas blackness and femaleness are sites of difference. But and then I bring it to their attention that isn't it been the case that all previous presidential elections have been about race and gender, right? And so then they think, because it's always been about whiteness and blackness. About whiteness and maleness. Mm-hmm. So it's only against whiteness and maleness as transcendental norms that blackness here and femaleness gets defined as different.
And
go ahead.
Yeah, and so that's maybe the yes part of your answer, and you also said there's kind of a no part to the answer of whether you can separate the history of these two bodies apart.
Yeah, I mean, in as much as it's true that it is this transcendental norm, and indeed a marker of privilege and power, which I can say more about later, but it's obviously the case that black folk in the United States have eked out their own existential meaning, right, by really taking that notion through an act of really inversion, and taking this notion of blackness and giving it a different kind of axiological meaning, a different kind of value meaning, and indeed narrating their own existence through their own struggles and experiences of exile and deracination and uprootedness and so on. So while it's true that blackness gets its sense by way of whiteness as a transcendental norm, it's not true that that blackness can be reduced to a whiteness as a transcendental norm.
Let's talk about transcendental norm for a while. I want to bring up in a short while an encounter you had with a white professor, and one very interesting thing among others about your book, Black Bodies, White Gazes, is that you continually bring up situations, real-life narratives, and you both describe them and theorize them and draw certain conclusions from race relations in practice. So, but before we do that, what do you mean when you write, for example, that whites see themselves as pure transcendence? And what kinds of assumptions about blacks and black bodies are integral to this kind of whiteness, to this aspect of whiteness?
Yeah, sure. And this language, by the way, the transcendent and transcendent versus facticity here are terms that Sartre, Jean-Paul Sartre, raises. And typically, it's the notion that whiteness is the is a site of exclusive transcendence, meaning that whites generally take themselves, and I'm thinking historically here, particularly in terms of many European philosophers, where there's the idea that whites are mind, right, M-I-N-D, and spirit, whereas blacks are reduced to their bodies, so they are what might be called facticity, right? They are immanence. And hence they have sort of experiences. As Hegel might say, the black or the African, the Negro, is sensuous in some sense and therefore lacks the ability of abstraction or abstraction of representation. But also this notion, again, of exclusive transcendence squares well with the notion of whiteness as a transcendental norm, because it means that whiteness goes unnamed in our culture or ex-nominated and is generally invisible. Which means then that blackness gets named or nominated and is visible. And one example that I try to bring out for my students is when we think about BET, Black Entertainment Television, here's a case where blackness is named.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And then I sort of pose the question, well, what is other to BET? Well, it's WET, W-E-T, right? It's white entertainment television.
Mm-hmm.
But that often goes unnamed, right? But there's something politically, I think, important, obviously, about naming blackness in this case. But nonetheless, whiteness remains unnamed. But again, this unnaming and whiteness as the transcendental norm and whiteness as exclusive transcendence, I think, speaks to the way in which whiteness is a mark of privilege and power. And one way in which I try to flesh this out is by way of educational theorist Peggy McIntosh's work, where she talks about whiteness as privilege. She talks about it as a kind of inheriting an invisible knapsack of privileges. And she gives various examples. I mean, she gives like 46 examples. I can't go through all of those, but two in particular. One is where she talks about how she, as a white woman, can go shopping alone pretty much most of the time without being harassed or without being followed. So there's something that she recognizes about her white body that renders her immune from this kind of surveillance from either from cameras or from security, right? And my students, they attempt to challenge me. Again, typically white students will react to this, and they'll argue, well, you know, I've been stopped in stores too. But when pressed on the issue, they often say things like, well, it was because of some other factor. You know, I may have been pierced, or I had tattoos, or maybe it's because I'm young. but they can't deliver a case in which they were stopped precisely because they were white. And of course, when in my own experiences and experiences of other blacks, and we've sort of critically discussed this, is where blacks are stopped in stores precisely because they're black. And you can have cases where, you know, you go into a store with a three-piece suit, and somehow the blackness, as it were, trumps the attire that one has, right? So the question becomes, what is it about blackness in a predominantly white society, in a society which is racist, that that creates a case where this blackness stands out as salient, right, over and above how one is dressed? And actually, Tim Wise, who has a wonderful example where he talks about driving in his car with tinted windows, and he has his radio blasting, and a white police officer pulls him over, and the police officer approaches the car. He rolls down his window, and the police officer says, "Oh." And so it's in that saying, "Oh," that there's this immediate recognition, and the attribution of innocence with regard to this black, with regard to this white body, because presumably the police officer thought that he might encounter a black body. So the "Oh," in some sense, says to us, you know, given all of these interesting raced markers, music playing, tinted windows, and lo and behold, there's a white, in some sense, he's relieved of any suspicion in virtue of being white. And then McIntosh also gives a wonderful example where she talks about the fact that white children aren't educated by their parents to be aware of systemic racism for their own daily protection. Again, this is something I raise with my students. And it's interesting to me when students tell me that their parents don't teach them about this, that you're not to sort of engage in these very quick movements around police officers. And, of course, Amadou Diallo is precedent here, right?
Mm-hmm.
So they're not warned to be careful around white police officers, but yet black children are warned often about this, you know, how they ought to perform publicly, because there's something about this black body that parents know is so saturated with things like criminality, and by that, by saturated, I mean at a symbolic level, as being criminal, as being deviant, as being up to no good. And I pose to my students, if this isn't happening to you, if your parents aren't teaching you this, what does that say about your whiteness, right? And inevitably, of course, we end up talking about the ways in which the white body is sort of a priori assumed a certain kind of innocence, right? So there's a presumptive element there in our society.
And innocence and goodness and purity and order, beauty, restraint, nobility, these are some of the words you use to describe and put into context whiteness as transcendence. I want to also point to a couple of the other examples that Peggy McIntosh, this critical theorist, gives.
Sure.
You cite 10 in your book, and two of them that really struck me were, one is, I can do well in a challenging situation without being called a credit to my race.
Yeah. Okay,
so this is one of the advantages that white people have that they don't think about much. And the other one is, I am never asked to speak for all the people of my racial group.
That's right. In particular, the first one there, in terms of being a credit to my race, when I bring this up to my students, they've never heard of it before, which is, again, very telling about, quote-unquote, the white experience. And there are many times where blacks have been successful, and they're told by blacks and whites, interestingly enough, that they're credits to their race, which implies that they are in some sense unique and distinct from the general horde, as it were, of other blacks who are simply mediocre.
Which brings us to one of the vignettes that you present in this book. We're speaking with George Yancey. He teaches in the philosophy department at Duquesne University, and we're talking about his most recent book, Black Bodies, White Gazes, The Continuing Significance of Race. And George joins us by phone from Pittsburgh. At a recent conference convened by the American Philosophical Association, you had an informal encounter, this is between sessions of the conference, with a well-respected white philosopher. And this philosopher congratulated you on a book you had recently edited. I think it was entitled The Philosophical Eye, Personal Reflections on Life and Philosophy.
Yes.
And in that book, in that contribution, your contribution to that book, you had used Black vernacular language. So what did the white philosopher tell you in this very informal setting?
Yes. In fact, I mean, in many ways, I think his intervention, as it were, at the conference that day, really sort of belied the logic of that text, because it was designed specifically to bring philosophy down to earth, to look at the relationship between philosophers and what is it about their identities that got them into philosophy, and how do their identities speak to their philosophical projects. So he had read my chapter, which was entitled Between Possibility and Facticity, and lo and behold, he said, you know, I had learned a lot about you that I hadn't known previously, and then he said to me, why is it that you used that language? And of course, he underscored that language. And the thing is, I mean, in writing my own philosophical autobiography, I wrote that chapter, and the assumption was that I'd work with what linguist Geneva Smitherman refers to as the language of my nurture. That's what she calls it when she's referring to African American language. So there's a sense in which, you know, that language was the language of my nurture, right? So in order to articulate my identity, I had to use that language. And his question, right, when he posed that question, why did you use that language, reminded me, I think, that he thought that I was using an ersatz language, a childlike language, an inferior language, and that language was incapable of communicating brilliant, you know, and profound philosophical ideas. So I think he brought that to that text a priori, you know. And some might, I mean, or one might argue that it was a question of class only. Now, why I argue that class was operative in that encounter, it was also about race. And the reason I argue that is because, basically, I was being reminded not to speak like some of my black colleagues, because, interestingly enough, he went on to tell me about a black philosopher who he had seen and heard give a lecture, and he talked about how horrible the English was, right? And, of course, he didn't even ask whether I knew this person. So there was something about that language and that black colleague of mine that he was, you know, trying to make a very tight connection with. And I was told that he said, you know, you speak well. So in some sense, he meant that I speak well as a black person. So again, it was an insult, right? And if if one takes the connection between language and identity seriously, I mean, which I do, in some sense, I think that he was saying, turn white. Which is, you know, problematic, right? Because there you are, African-American philosophers make up about 1.1% of the professional philosophers, and so we're already we're already on the margins, as it were, in terms of numbers. But here I am in this benign context, right, a social everyday encounter where whiteness is operating at this very insidious level, and where you know, race is being brought in at a very subtle level in relationship to my language. But, you know, it's interesting that he happens to be the same colleague, and I'm glad to say he's not a colleague at Duquesne, and he's the same colleague who says to me, you know, George, you could be as good as or better than, and then he names a black philosopher, right? And it's almost as if I can't be, you know, as good as or better than someone like Richard Rorty or Quine or Wittgenstein, right, or Kant. He always places another black philosopher, which, again, is an insult in each case.
George Yancey joins us today on Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio, online at kpfa.org. My name is C.S. Song. George has edited a number of books, including African American Philosophers, 17 Conversations, Critical Perspectives on Bell Hooks, and Narrative Identity, Psychologists Engaged in Self-Construction. We're talking about his latest book, Black Bodies, White Gazes, The Continuing Significance of Race, published by Roman and Littlefield. We have on againstthegrain.org links to both that book, Black Bodies, White Gazes, as well as to George's homepage at Duquesne University, where he is an assistant professor of philosophy. You write that the white philosopher, this guy you encountered, at this conference, he remained silent about his own identity as white, but his interaction with me served to constitute his whiteness. What do you mean by this?
Yeah, by that I mean, as he gave me the advice, the quote-unquote advice, in some sense, his whiteness remained invisible to him, so that he thought, he was under the impression that he was giving me advice when he said to me, why did you use that language, right? But in the process of defining the language that I used as that language, which clearly entailed, again, that language was an ersatz, inferior language, he in some sense constituted me in ways that I did not see myself. So I saw myself as really engaging in a philosophical project of making sense of who I am as a philosopher, and as a black philosopher in particular, who has a specific history, and as such is ensconced within a particular linguistic community. And in doing so, that is a very positive spin, right? But he constituted me as this person who was sort of engaging in baby talk or engaging in slang or broken English or something of the sort. But in doing this, and this is the way power works, I think this is the way power works, this is how whiteness works, rather, as a site of power, it remains invisible to itself. So it's not that he, as it were, realized that, hey, I'm speaking from this perspective of whiteness, right, that mediates my judgment. Rather, he saw himself as it were, speaking the truth. And the truth was basically to set me free of this this distortion of the English language, right? And at another interesting level, in some sense, he was saying that African-American vernacular wasn't really capable of communicating philosophical ideas. You know, there was something about it, unlike French or German or standard American English, that it just couldn't articulate and express philosophical ideas. So again, he was not only operating from the level of class, but he was operating from this level of whiteness as the transcendental norm, whiteness as the unnamed, the ex-nominated, as that side of privilege.
What does white privilege do, in your opinion, to the capacity or willingness of whites to consciously reflect on what it means to be white in society?
Yeah, that's a very good question. I think that coming out of a Marxist tradition that argues that there's something about those who occupy different places in society that in some sense occludes certain kinds of cognition. And I think that argument works very well with respect to whiteness. A lot of philosophers have done work around this in an area called standpoint epistemology, and that's precisely what it is, or in an area known as epistemology of ignorance, where one's constitution as white, one's social constitution as white, in some sense creates blinkers that blinds the individual from seeing their own privilege, right? But they're capable of seeing the black body, right, in ways that they deem that are clear and that are epistemologically accurate, right? Epistemology meaning there's a knowledge claim being made about that black body. But I think that in many ways it fundamentally prevents a kind of reaching out or a kind of movement toward the black body in a way that would be much more existentially robust, right? So not only are these blinkers sort of prohibiting a certain kind of cognition, but they're also prohibiting a certain kind of transaction, a certain kind of relationality with the black body, one that is healthy, right? One that is fruitful in some way.
Let's take another physical, concrete situation that you present in this book. This situation takes place in an elevator. You write that you are dressed in a suit and tie, so you're very well dressed. You enter an elevator where a white woman waits to reach her floor. She sees you, and of course she sees that you are a man and that you are black. How does she physically respond? How have you noticed her physically responding?
Yeah, sure. Before I say something about that,
sure.
I'd like to just say something about the way in which I understand race, so that I'm not misread as saying somehow that race is this biological category, right? Because once I clarify that, you can see how this dynamic is taking place in the elevator. It's not that I'm arguing that there's something intrinsically about the black body on that elevator in that space that signifies something called race, right? It's not that my body signifies something called race in the realist sense that when we talk about stars or electrons or black holes or something like that. But race is here a social construction. That's the way I'm looking at it. But yet it's real. And it's objective, meaning that it has this kind of outward social impact in our everyday lives based on the sort of interstitial lives that we lead.
In other words, people can say race is not based in biology, but you, George Yancey, are saying, well, that may be true, but race still exists.
That's right. Mm-hmm. That's right. So we're moving from a natural ontology, if you will, to a social ontology, which means a social mode of being. And this is what race is. So I find myself in this elevator, and the elevator is just a wonderful site for doing this because it is a social space, and that it is deemed fairly mundane, and it's something that we all experience, but we don't reflect on it critically, right? So there's this white woman in the elevator, and I argue that the space within the elevator is already raced, meaning when she's in the elevator, she's already constituting the normative space of the elevator. We often talk about race as spaced in terms of segregation, but we don't generally talk about space as raced, right?
Mm.
So here's a case where space itself is raced. So when I enter the elevator, she immediately sees me, right? And in seeing me, she interpolates me, and I use that term throughout the text, and by that I just mean something like that she hails me in some way. She is calling me in a certain kind of way. And what's interesting, I mean, Jean-Paul Sartre argued that, for the last 300 years, the white man has been basically the look. He says that the white man has been a seer without being seen. So in some sense, this white woman in the elevator constitutes the look. She is the white gaze, right? And that through her attitudes that she brings on that elevator and her glances, indeed through her movements, in some sense she fixes me, as Fanon says. She fixes me like a die when she sort of looks at me but yet doesn't want to look at me, right? So she clutches her purse, right? She moves a bit closer to the corner of the elevator and she looks up slightly, again, not wanting to look directly at me. And there's a way in which, in that elevator space, I have become the intruder of that space. I'm an invader when I walk on to that elevator because she has already pre-constituted that space as her space. And I argue that when I get on that elevator, she confiscates the meaning of my body. And I use confiscate there specifically because of its etymology. It means fiscus, comes from the word fiscus, which means literally purse or treasury, in the sense that something is taken with authority. So in some sense, there's a kind of asymmetricality in the elevator in relationship to the history of white women in these kinds of spaces. So her gaze, her voice, her presence, in some sense, can trump mine, right? So she confiscates my body. My body's not being lynched, it's not being castrated, it's not being brutalized, but there is a kind of violence that's taking place. And the violence is that she constructs me as this criminal, right, as I enter the elevator. And I refer to this as a form of epistemic violence. By epistemic, again, it's a kind of knowing violence where although my moral sense of who I am doesn't crumble, namely, I know myself as this good person that I am. I know that I'm not this rapist or this criminal. But in some sense, it's through her imaginary that an act of violence is being done, and it's through my catching a glimpse of myself as she sees me as this violent predator that there's an act of violence.
And then the question is, and I know white students in your class have brought this up to you, the question is, how do you know? How do you know that the white woman sees you in this way? There are many, say, I don't know whether the proper word is role models, but there are plenty of African-American men, well-dressed, in suits, looking kind of corporate, who don't maybe typically arouse feelings of fear or feelings of I'm going to stereotype you as a criminal in the white mind. So by what authority are you saying this is what the white woman is thinking?
Sure. I mean, that's an excellent question. And interestingly enough, before the publication of the book, I would go around in various universities giving lectures on this. And actually, an African-American president of a university walked up to me, and that's where I got the title of that chapter one. His students asked him, and colleagues, had you ever experienced the elevator effect? And he said, of course. What's interesting about this is that when I've given talks, the blacks in the audience shake their heads in affirmation, even the women, identifying with this particular elevator experience. In conversation with whites, even a conversation with a white male philosopher who is very tall in stature, right, he talks about how he's never experienced that particular experience, you know, that particular moment of being identified as a threat. So there's a sense in which it's a kind of universality to this experience, and I'm not saying that in every case, right, but there's a kind of universality amongst the people that I've talked to. But the authority, I think, comes in at the level of critical discussion with other black people who've had that experience. So it's not just guesswork, right? There's a sense in which blacks have gotten on these elevators, found themselves in these spaces, and have gotten their bodies interpolated in precisely the way in which I'm talking about it. And I think we might argue that what happens here is the authority is embedded in what I like to call an epistemological community, meaning a community of knowers, right? There's something that particular kinds of bodies experience intersubjectively and talk about, just as women can talk about sexism in ways that men can't, right? Because they have these particular experiences. So I think a similar thing is happening here, where black bodies find themselves in circumstances where the white gaze is being very violent to their bodies. So I think the authority then is purchased at the level of intersubjective discussion, intersubjective agreement, and at the level of shared experience.
We're going to take a short break and be back to talk more with George Yancey, who teaches philosophy at Duquesne University. His name is spelled Yancy. And we're talking about his latest book, Black Bodies, White Gazes. We have links to that book as well as to his homepage at Duquesne on our website, againstthegrain.org. Please stay with us. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio, online at kpfa.org. The associate producer is H.N. Nguyen. Sally Phillips is at the controls. I'm C.S. Song. And George Yancey joins us by phone from his home in the Pittsburgh area. He has written for journals like African American Review, Philosophy and Social Criticism, and the Western Journal of Black Studies, and his books include Philosophy in Multiple Voices and What White Looks Like, African-American Philosophers on the Whiteness Question. His latest book is Black Bodies, White Gazes, The Continuing Significance of Race, published by Roman and Littlefield. You are a philosopher. You're deeply steeped in the philosophical tradition, or you're probably critical of quite a bit of it, but this is part of your terrain, your academic terrain. And I think you mentioned Kant, Immanuel Kant, early on. Let's talk about David Hume and Immanuel Kant. These are sort of some of the paradigmatic white Western philosophers. What did they have to say about blacks in comparison with whites? And maybe that'll help give us some historical grounding into some of the ideas you're talking about.
Yeah, sure, absolutely. And I think it's important to note that, and I tell my graduate students, I have to remind them that despite the fact that David Hume and Immanuel Kant were racists, we shouldn't, therefore, not study their work. You know, it's important that we do so. But, I use them in the text. I draw from their work in order to historically buttress this notion that whiteness is the transcendental norm. And David Hume was quite clear that he was suspicious that Negroes, as he put it, were naturally inferior to whites. And he notes in one of his essays on national characters, he notes that there's a Jamaican guy, someone from Jamaica, and that person is spoke of highly as a Negro who has some learning. But Hume says immediately, undercuts that by saying that, but he's probably a parrot, right? He only parrots stuff. So you know, if I were around Hume and I said something like, you know, to be or not to be, that is the question, whether 'tis noble in the mind to suffer the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune, or to take arms against the sea of trouble and by opposing in them, Hume would say, well, sure, he can reiterate that, but he has no capacity to explain it, right, to explore what it means. And Immanuel Kant, actually, in his work, he repeats Hume. He basically says that Hume challenges us to find any civilization other than white that tops it in some way, right? And interestingly enough, though, Kant talks about a black carpenter through a priest by the name of Father Labatt, who had spoken to this carpenter, and the carpenter had said something about whites allowing a great deal of latitude, white men allowing a great deal of latitude to their wives, and then complaining later when they upset them. And Father Labatt shared this with Kant, and Kant said, well, there's something to this logic, right? And then when Kant found out that he was black, Kant simply said that, you know, since he was black from head to toe, what he said was clearly stupid. So it's interesting that, you know, it's almost as if Kant, were he to talk to me over the phone, he might say that what I'm saying is very intelligent, brilliant, you know, whatever he might say. But then once he gets to meet me and sees that I'm black, he would automatically argue then, he would have to withdraw the claim that what I said must have been stupid because I'm black from head to toe. So authoritative voices, this is how I call them, help to cement whiteness as the transcendental norm. And you have, you know, not only Hume and Kant, you've got Hegel, you've got Count de Buffon, Carl von Linnaeus, Georges Cuvier, Samuel Cartwright. You have all of those European figures and American figures who were very much espousing an ideology of whiteness as superiority.
A lot of people might say, well, let's see, the subtitle of this book is The Continuing Significance of Race, and we have Obama, who will be in the White House very soon, and we have all these people saying that we've reached kind of a colorblind state today. And I'm wondering, and you address this in your book, whether you feel that whiteness as terror, as a violent tormentor of black bodies, whether you think that is a thing of the past or it continues.
Yeah, I think it continues, but I think that the Obama phenomenon raises a particular challenge. And in the book, in the introduction, actually, I pose an important question, and the question is, you know, that, you know, I sort of pose, first of all, I pose the point that social scientists will long be engaged in a discussion about Obama and how he got elected by so many whites. And the question will become, you know, what is it about Obama as a black man did whites not see or fail to see or refuse to see to vote for him? I think there's something about, obviously, about Obama. The way in which I look at it, again, is through this kind of philosophical lens. Ideographically, these two very interesting constructs, ideographically and monothetically. And ideographic is where you basically look at the characteristics of an individual. So, I mean, obviously, Obama, you know, he's young, he's elegant, you know, he's articulate, he has charisma. You know, he espouses a politics of hope and change. His style is not a kind of tit for tat politics. And in many ways, I think too, Obama, his very body, as it were, right, his corporeality carries within it the DNA of unity, which is a really fascinating notion, right? And I say the DNA, so to speak, right? Mm-hmm. His DNA carries the hope and possibility. And of course, he has this ability to engage in this capacity, rather, to engage in a discourse that is nonpartisan. But what's interesting is that's ideographically, but nomothetically, if you think about Obama within this context, you think that, you know, during this time of his victory, people are weary and they're angry about the war, they're concerned about the economy, they're unhappy with the last 8 years, right, and so on. So bring both of these things together, and I think that, you know, so we can sort of begin to create a framework in which we can understand Obama's success. Yet, I'm critical of those who I think see him as ushering in some sort of post-race moment in American history, and I think that notion is Pollyannish. I think it's just absolutely false. But I also think it's dangerous, and I say that because you know, racism preceded Obama. It will continue during his tenure, and it will, you know, continue afterward. And I remember reading one blog where a black mother said something like, "You know, my daughter should never come to me ever again and complain about racism, because now that, you know, we've gotten this far with Obama, you know, being president-elect, she can't complain. She has no legitimate basis upon which to complain." So I see that as terribly dangerous, and I say that because the point of the matter is, look, the fact is that blacks are three times more likely to be profiled by police, right? Even as whites, when they are stopped, are four times likely to have, you know, illegal stuff, to have contraband. It won't change the fact that when African Americans go and attempt to get loans, they're two to three times more likely to be rejected. So these stats, these realities will stay in place. So I think it's important that we just understand that racism, we're not in this fictitional post-race moment because of that, and I think because of his election, I think we also have to think about what is it about Obama, what is it about him when whites see him, right? And I remember I was teaching race course on race and film, and we were looking at Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, and I remember the way in which Sidney Poitier is depicted as Dr. Prentice. And, you know, he goes to Yale, and he has, you know, he's published some books, and he's this, you know, this very elite black character. But there's something about that black character during the time of the movie that made him much more palatable to whites, right? So I'm saying that those whites who voted for Obama can still be racist based on the way in which I understand racism. So it's not incompatible to vote for an Obama and yet be racist. So in other words, then I don't take it that his election is a signification that we are in this post-race moment. I mean, it says something about America, but it doesn't tell us what is it about particular individual whites who voted for Obama and what they either had to see or forced themselves to see in order to vote for him.
George Yancey, author most recently of Black Bodies, White Gazes, The Continuing Significance of Race, links on againstthegrain.org. I'm CS, and I want to spend some time with you, George, on the book's last chapter, in which you write about how insidious whiteness is, and then you look at the etymology of the word insidious and draw some conclusions from that. What sure. does the word insidious mean?
Yeah, sure. The word insidious, and you know, I've heard many people say that racism is insidious, but when I thought, okay, let me find out exactly what's going on with insidious, and it means subtle, right? But etymologically, it comes from the word which means it's insidiae, which means to ambush, which is a really dynamic term that captures the way in which racism is lived. Tim Wise, again, I mean, who does really excellent work on this, has been, you know, writing about, you know, whiteness and anti-racism for years, right? And here's a situation where he, defining himself as an anti-racist, he gets on an airplane and he sees that there are black pilots in the cockpit, and he says, "Oh my God, can these guys fly the plane?" Right.
So
here's a case where someone like Wise, of all people, you know, he has this moment where, though he self-identifies as anti-racist, he has this experience where he's ambushed by the kinds of deep-seated racism that is still, as it were, in his unconscious, in his body. There's a woman by the name of Lillian Smith who wrote a book called Killers of the Dream, and she's sort of before her time. And she talks about getting together with a group of white women, must have been in the 40s maybe, and they were going to integrate this eating area. And she shares this experience where another white woman, though, as she says, clear in her conscience, felt this acute sense of nausea as she sat with the blacks at the table, right? And so there's something about it that says something about the way in which racism is not simply getting ideas right, right? It's not just a cognitive issue. It's the way in which, because if it was just a cognitive issue, then Tim Wise would be okay, right? This woman mm-hmm. would have been fine. But there's a way in which racism resides in our very bodies, in our very unconscious, So I critique this notion that to be an anti-racist white is somehow to occupy some non-racist apex, right, of where one could say, "I have arrived," right? Because there is no arrival in the way in which I understand this, because whiteness is constitutive of the self. And being constitutive, then, it's not something that you can sort of unpack, right, in a day or in a year, over 5 years. So it's going to require what Du Bois says is long siege. You know, that's what it's going to require. Because it not only requires investigating the unconscious, but it also involves investigating the way in which one's body is fixed, the way in which one's movements are fixed. So the woman in the elevator, for an example, she may not even be aware cognitively that she's tugging on her purse, but her body has become so habituated in its movement vis-a-vis black bodies that she automatically does this, right? And so by way of thinking critically about what whites ought to do, I argue that what whites should do is to really throw themselves in contexts where they're unfamiliar with that particular kind of sphere, so that they find themselves or put themselves in context where blacks are, so that the ambush experience can be encouraged. And if the ambush experience is encouraged, then that allows them to be thankful, as it were, right, that they thought they understood who they were as non-racist, but realizing that there are depths to this racism. And so it allows a bridge for communicating with blacks, and it also allows a bridge to this stranger within, right? Call it this the unconscious expression of whiteness. It allows for this communication with this stranger within, and a critical communication with that stranger, such that one can become a more whole individual. But again, never complete, right? So this wholeness or completeness is always something that one is striving toward when it comes to whiteness.
To what extent is fighting state structures and power disparities that contribute to or result in racial oppression, to what extent is that important to white anti-racist work?
Yeah, I think it's very important. And if you, I mean, in part of, this is part of my critique of critical whiteness theorists, they've heretofore limited their critiques in an autobiographical sense. So they're talking about their own lives as whites and how they can overcome or undo whiteness. It's really a performative metaphor that they use, which has its own problems. But I think you're right. I think that if we think about the state, as it were, the state as a site of white power, then to really think about the ways in which whiteness is operative in our society, it's going to require more than simply exploring, you know, the depths of the unconscious and putting oneself in a situation where one is bound to experience an ambush, you know, having that ambush occur, where one is dealing again with the unconscious or dealing with others. I think that at bottom, what is required is this issue of attacking the societal structure, the way in which racism is systemic. And without that, I think that that while we'll make steps at the individual level in terms of undoing whiteness in some way, one is still going to maintain a level of power and a level of privilege in terms of how one has a particular position within that larger society.
And very quickly, George, what can and should people of color do to help whites committed to their anti-racist work?
Yeah, I think that they should feel. Not feel overly obligated to do so, because then you don't want to sort of carry this burden. But again, black people have carried this burden for a long time. But I think that whites can't come to terms with white racism without making or having blacks be a critical voice in that discussion. So I think it's important that we balance that discussion, because inevitably it's not whites who are suffering, although they are suffering from whiteness, but it's blacks who are experiencing that at the level of, you know, bodily injury, death, pain, etc. So it's important that we remain a part of that larger dialogue.
George Yancey, Yancy, teaches philosophy at Duquesne University, editor of numerous books, and author of Black Bodies, White Gazes, The Continuing Significance of Race. Again, links on our homepage, againstthegrain.org. Hey, George, thanks so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you.
And this is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, and we will look for you next time. Against the Grain is produced by C.S. Song with associate producer H.N. Yuen. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you can submit comments and find ways to reach us. You can also call us at 510-848-6767, extension 670. And thanks to Sally Phillips, who is at the controls today.